Thank you, Jenny, and thank all of you for coming. I'm going to try and talk this talk rather than read it, in part because of the setup and in part because if I read it, it'll be way too long and there's not a lot of light, so I think it's going to be okay. As Jenny said, I've been working on a project on Pine Flat specifically, and in particular, today I want to talk about the film Pine Flat, completed in 2005. It's a film with a running length of about 138 minutes, and it makes its debut in early 2006 at the Sundance Festival. And I'm going to use its form to think a little bit about the pastoral and about questions of sort of time and milieu and childhood in Sharon Lockhart's work. The Pine Flat is the title of the film, and the title card appears very briefly at the beginning of the film, as you see it. And the first scene opens here in the winter on a hillside. It's what a director is, or what you would call in cinema, an establishing shot. It tells you where you are, I suppose. It tells you that you're in Pine Flat, or it gives you a sense of locale. What it ends up establishing, however, isn't entirely clear. Not much happens. A little way into the running length of the shot, you hear a voice, a child's voice, probably a female child's voice, calling out, "Ethan, Ethan, where are you?" And according to, I guess you could say, a sort of cinematic convention, the establishing shot should be followed then by a close-up, either at the person talking, the person yelling, the child, or at Ethan, or at least further into the scene, to move from the sort of medium-long shot that is the establishing shot convention to something like into not only the scene, but into the narrative, into what the topic or subject of Pine Flat is. That doesn't happen. The film continues to run. The sound is ambient sound. You hear the sound of the child's voice a few more times. But more than that, you hear the sound of wind. You hear the sound of kind of the rustling of tree branches. The sounds of nature, you could say, sort of overwhelm and tend to swallow up the voice. But the scene doesn't change. It holds sort of this monocular vision continually. And when, about 7 minutes in, you hear the cry or howl of a wolf or coyote, which sort of should, in a sense, take you once again into the scene, by then you're sort of going, that's not the kind of movie this is. I end up thinking about a variety of things, both about the film itself, but also kind of watching what's going on in that scene. As the snow falls, as fog rolls in and out, that the standard conventions of narrative film are clearly not there, and what the temporality of the film is something else. To go back to the kind of oldest moment of one's own film theoretical formation, Walter Benjamin quotes the French, the early 20th century French novelist and physician Georges Duhamel complaining about film, about the fact that film won't let him, cinema doesn't let him think his own thoughts. As soon as one has formed a thought, or even partially formed a thought, the film has moved on. That you can't, in a sense, Benjamin glosses this quote, you can't muse in front of the cinema. You can't sort of, again, think your own thoughts, or even hold a conversation with yourself, which is what you end up doing over this first shot in Pine Flat, where minutes in, one ends up thinking about what it is one's watching and watching itself, the specifics of what takes place in the camera frame, or in the tableau, if you will, to borrow a painting term, and the relationship between that, say, and the convention of cinema. The other side of Walter Benjamin's position, what he has Georges Duhamel speak on behalf of, in a sense, is how one might look at a painting rather than how one looks at a film. Where in film you cannot think your own thoughts, in paintings you're absorbed. You are contemplative, or as Benjamin might say at the time, it's a kind of antisocial behavior by the second decade of the 20th century. And then as one is thinking these thoughts, apropos of nothing in particular within the narrative, since in a sense there isn't one, the scene changes. It's late spring, early summer, and there's a figure reading, a girl probably 11 or 12 years old, reading. And this scene too, in a sense, although not yet given, continues for the same measured 10-minute time span that the opening shot did. In many ways, the reader is the kind of true establishing shot of the film. It sets us in a particular season, and it sets up the relationship between film and painting, between the moving image and the still image, and between absorption and distraction as terms, as possibilities. One might think of the reader as a kind of painterly scene to begin with, in ways that I'll think about or discuss, but one of the things that, and it's something that everyone who writes on Pine Flat, and indeed on Sharon Lockhart's work coming towards Pine Flat, is first of all the idea of the painterly, the tableau, the overall composition of the rectangle, but also the flatness. Mark Godfrey writes a great essay in the initial Pine Flat catalog called Pine Flat, The Flatness of Pine Flat, and talks about how in all of Lockhart's film work, there's a cutting out of the horizon, a filling in of the scene or the composition in such a way that the broad, expansive spaces that we might expect from something like the Western American landscape are in fact held in, closed on the surface, composed more like painting is, at least since the 1860s, than like the great sweep of the cinematic view or the cinematic landscape. And it's not just the kind of Pine Flat image, you could say, that even before that, and perhaps more insistently before that, critics writing about works like Sharon Lockhart's Gosho Gwaka from 2001, I think, although that page was long since gone here in this pile, write about the way in which the work maps and grids the flat rectangle, not the perspectival or the deep filmic or the scenic rectangle, but the flat surface where that stage, red stage screen in the back, the drawings of the basketball court, the line of the basketball court sort of limits the space, measures it out both in depth and across the surface, and the way in which the junior high school basketball team runs across this field over and over again through a set of drills and exercises and choreographed movements, again, maps and grids the space, or as Frank Stella once remarked about his own sort of nesting rectangles and grids, it forces illusionism out at a regularized rate so that you get the kind of pounding of feet, pounding of feet, and the kind of repeated gridding of the space. In that sense, what you could think of the reader as a more conventional painting. It is painterly, but you could say the tradition it refers to isn't so much the 20th century abstract tradition, the tradition of flatness, but something more like 18th century painting. And indeed, it's a linkage that Lockhart herself makes. She talks about being in graduate school at Art Center and the importance of, at the time she was there, of Michael Fried's essay on painting in the age of Diderot entitled Absorption and Theatricality, which sets out terms that are redolent of Walter Benjamin's distinction between absorption and distraction that marked the distinction between painting and film. But it also gives us the handy word absorption allows us to think about our relationship to the reader and how we, like, as it were, read the scene, view the scene, see it. At some point early on in the 10 minutes of the reader, the one switches, you could say, from watching with its good sort of paranoiac narrativizing implications to looking. The looking, I think, shifts back and forth, I would argue, between looking at the reader herself, which we're allowed to do in the 10-minute run, noting where she brushes her hair back from her forehead, but even more insistently, one begins to follow her eyes down the page. The ambient sound is again wind and the rustling of leaves, but also really nicely and crisply the turning of the page. Four pages turn over the course of the 10 minutes, and one begins to, as I say, follow her eyes as she reads down one page, up again, and down across the other, absorbed within the text. The book, she will tell an interviewer at Sundance in 2006, is a Lemony Snicket. So you can, there's a lot that will rest on this, but I mean, she's absorbed within this text in the way that we might be absorbed within the project of looking. That our time and the time of looking and her time and the time of reading match one another. There's a, and it's a distinction that Fried will make when he, in Absorption and Theatricality, when he talks about the absorbed activities, the diversions, but also the kind of absorbing activities of Chardin's Boy Blowing Bubbles from the National Gallery of Art, or Fragonard's from the Met, and Fragonard's Girl Reading from the National Gallery, that give us a sense of these actors' own absorption within the their act as a kind of mirror, or a proleptic mirroring, as Fried will put it, of our own absorption within the work itself. As though the time of the child, or the time of the reader, and the time of the viewer become the same time, and become a time marked by a certain kind of timelessness, a certain kind of absorptive relationship to the work. As though the work were a different space. A space one might want to think of, or begin to think of, as a pastoral space. Now, the pastoral as a tradition goes way back, and at some point I will end up rifling through my pages here to quote from Virgil or Theocritus or somebody or another at the origins of the pastoral in classical Greek literature. But by the 19th century, a few things have happened, you could say, that make the reader on the hillside, particularly the female reader on the hillside, an emblem of the pastoral. The novel and the emergence of the novel, you could say, is quickly and early on, particularly by those frightened by it, gendered as something that belongs to, that is written for and read by women from the beginning, from the first complaints by French philosophers and British theologians, but and linked precisely to absorptiveness, linked precisely to the sense that the novel takes them away from the social. It takes them away from family, it takes them away from chores, it takes them away from work. Its temporality is not clock time, nor is it chore time. Its temporality lies somewhere else. And by the middle of the 19th century, the figure of the woman reader, and particularly the woman reader out of doors, becomes a kind of regular theme. This is Monet, a work sometimes called Springtime, or Winslow Homer, Girl Reading by Brooke. Homer is a touchstone for Lockhart. As she begins to go back and forth to Pine Flat, a small town, well, town is not the right word, a census-designated place of about 150 people on the edge of the Sequoia National Forest, she begins to take with her a kind of research folder, a research folder that runs from John Steinbeck, whose settings for Grapes of Wrath are in the valley below the Sierra Nevadas there, to paintings by Winslow Homer, and perhaps particularly this one, the new novel, that situates itself in ways that are important and appropriate for thinking about Pine Flat and the time and space of Pine Flat. Homer is in the folder here with a folder there with Sharon Lockhart, with the new novel, with Two Boys in the Pasture, with Snap the Whip, and indeed with paintings by Andrew Wyeth, with film stills from Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven, with a variety of different sort of possibilities for a rural landscape, for imagining a kind of landscape. In fact, the reclining reader of the new novel is, I would argue, sort of a visual touchstone, not only for the reader on the hill of Lemony Snicket, but also of the image that was Jenny used on the card for the invitation or mailer for this evening's lecture, which is the fourth scene of the first portion of Pine Flat. This child sleeping at the edge of a creek or brook up against a limestone rock. So I would want to trace this history, I guess, or the tradition within which Lockhart has composed that opening scene and its themes of absorption, of a separation from action and the activities of daily life, and linking that and link that to the distinction again that Walter Benjamin makes between film and painting, and particularly on the side of the viewer and how it is that viewers relate to the time of painting versus the time, at least, of narrative cinema, where the cinema itself or the film itself, as it were, drives time diegetically. The long take, the measured out 10-minute take in ways that I'll return to, allows for a different kind of experience of temporality that might be, again, outside of the machine and the machines. That Lockhart is signaling the pastoral. Let me go back to George Duhamel. Basically, who says you can't think in cinema because the image is always changing. Duhamel is basically complaining about montage. You know, the way in which one scene becomes another scene becomes another scene, and that Benjamin is already writing about in terms of shock, drawing on Eisenstein. And we could say the modern film spectacle continues to work that way. The Lockhart's Pine Flat is an incredibly slow montage. That is to say, meaning, I think, I would argue, does build in the relationship between one scene and the next. But the scenes come 10 minutes after one another. And so you could say it is a kind of glacial montage. Mm-hmm. But when this scene appears, it's clear the pastoral has been signaled. We have, in essence, this, to borrow from Matisse's music of 1907, or Picasso's Panpipes from 1923, we have the ancient figure of the piping shepherd at the brook or at the creek. Here he sits, and it is as though Theocritus's characters, and in fact, I'm not going to try and dig out Theocritus. Let me just say that the opening scene is a shepherd and a goatherd, and they are each playing and singing and on their lunch break. You know, the sheep are doing whatever the sheep are doing, the goats are doing whatever the goats are doing, and these two guys are talking. And they're complimenting one another about how beautiful their music is. And they liken the music specifically to the sound of the brook, the sound of water as it falls down and as it ripples and flows, and that the music that is played is somehow even yet sweeter than that. So Lockhart, intentionally or no, is giving us a kind of, well, the signal is the pastoral. And here not only meaning a kind of rustic or agrarian landscape, a rural landscape, but more than that, a literary form. And a literary form with a long history and indeed a long pictorial history. What's equally interestingly about it is how much this kid, his name is Mikey, fails at the pastoral, or how oddly related to the pastoral he is. There's his particularness, that is to say, insofar as this is a photographic image rather than a painted one or a literary one, there's the real particulars of any photographic character. The haircut, the pants that he's wearing, the particular sort of movements he has, the facial expressions that he has, that link it sort of less to the allegorized or classicized or archaicized figures of Picasso and Matisse, or even to the classicized figures of Thomas Aiken's Arcadia of 1863, an interesting image for the middle of the Civil War, but that's a kind of different question already. But the strange way in which the Arcadian myth or the Arcadian subject is grafted to the American landscape or to a dream of America and mediated through the peculiarity of the photograph. There's a whole series of Aiken's photographs where his students and friends from the Pennsylvania Academy of Art join him on the banks of Mill Creek and pose in the nude as piping figures, as figures who belong to a kind of pastoral other place, rather than to the specifics of Philadelphia and its suburbs in the 1860s, and rather than to the indexical specific of the photograph. Mikey, you could say, is situated sort of in between those and referring to those. And he can't play the harmonica. Over and over again, he's playing the same sort of 7 or 8 note ditty. And he plays it faster, he plays it slower, he experiments with drawing air in through the reeds rather than blowing it out of the reeds. He washes it off in the creek. He gets attacked by a swarm of ladybugs, and he picks those off and becomes interested in looking at those. Against the absorption of the reader, it becomes a kind of emblem of distraction, where he is distracted sort of one thing after another from the project. A couple of interesting things, though, that happen here. I mean, one is that distraction is allowed to become in itself another form of absorption, another form of examining something when he spends time with the ladybug or with the harmonica or looking at things just in that pool in front of him. That it's a way that, as it were, the time of the 10 minutes passes. And it passes differently than it did in the reader. And the reader, not to make a pun, the reader and the viewer were on the same page. You know, the time was the same. Here the time is really like we want it to end. And Mikey wants it to end. Or at least there's a sense that we're feeling the time differently than we did in the first scene. The and we feel it pass more slowly. At the end of Pine Flat, when Lockhart screens the film for the children who were in it and for their families and for the people in the community at Pine Flat, in a small community center that Pine Flat is even too small to have, so it's in the next town down the mountain, one of the kids remarks that the harmonica scene felt a lot longer than 10 minutes. And we can say that, this is a kind of lived time, as Bergson would put it, that time is a lived experience in relation to waiting, to frustration, to absorption, what George Santayana would call sentimental time, by which he means sensed, although sentimental is also a good word here, time, as opposed to clock time, linear time, measured time. Bergson would suggest that time can't be measured. What you're measuring when you measure time is in fact space. That hands are going around clocks at a particular rate, or in this case, film is running through a machine. The hard 10 minutes of the Pine Flat segue, or the Pine Flat scenes, Pine Flat shots, is in a sense a kind of linear measure. But it's within that sort of hard 10 minutes that we're able to feel something like what time might feel like, what distraction might feel like, or the sense of antsiness that the young harmonica player offers us or gives us. There's another kind of time that gets measured out in the opening scenes or in the opening half of Pine Flat that moves us still well within the project, you could say, of the pastoral, towards, well within the confines or the possibilities, the definitions of the pastoral, and that is seasonal time. You can think of it as agrarian or natural time. But from the beginning, or from that first break to the reader on the late springtime hillside, to the young boy in the creek, to, with any luck, the young sleeper who's still on green grass, but a few leaves have begun to sort of accumulate, and he's got on a flannel shirt despite his bare feet, to the hunter doing that seasonal late summer, early autumn thing in camo and knit cap and in a bed of fallen leaves along a hillside, to finally the closing scene of the first movement, the first half of Pine Flat, which is a young boy waiting, rocking back and forth, pacing back and forth, that same kind of time, embodied time measurement, one could think of it as. One begins to feel the weight of the backpack, and clearly the weight of the backpack stands for something. The scene runs, again, 10 minutes. About 9 minutes into it, you hear the sound kind of familiarly of the diesel school bus running up, and the sound that is probably indelible for many people of the door of the school bus opening. And then we never see the bus, but the last 45 or so seconds of the 10 minutes, there's no child. It's just a kind of empty scene. Here, sentimental would be another good term. You could say that there's a way in which, clearly Pine Flat is not the first film to use a school bus to end something like an endless summer or the kind of shift from the seasonal passage of unstructured time in the summer to clock time, to the bell schedule, to school time. And in Pine Flat, it really is a displacement. In Pine Flat, kids as old as the kid in this scene go to school downhill. they go to school in Tulare, or they go to school in Visalia, or they go to school in one of the towns along U.S. Highway 99 down in the valley. So that there's a kind, so Pine Flat, you could say, in the figure of the school bus, becomes a separate place. But it's already, and we could think of the school bus as marking with Leo Marx and George Innes here, the machine in the garden. The Machine in the Garden is the title of Leo Marx's book on the pastoral, specifically in relation to American literature, from Thomas Jefferson's Notes on Virginia to Moby Dick. It's kind of a sort of expansive sort of American studies project. But it talks about how thinkers like Jefferson and Thoreau and Hawthorne and others address, in a sense, the coming of industrialization, the coming of kind of regimented, and particularly urban population, an urban nation, in relation to a political system, a social system, and an identity that's built on the agrarian or the rural, which is not particularly where I wanted to go, but this is Lackawanna Valley by George Innes, and you can see the train kind of running through a standard sort of clawed version of the pastoral setting, as though it were the Campania outside of Rome, except transferred here and situated. One of the things that Lockhart does is she carves out Pine Flat as a separate space, and in many ways, a painting space. Pine Flat is situated against, I would argue, the idea of the anthropological or the ethnographic or the realist or the record. Lockhart is sometimes talked about in terms of a kind of ethnography. But Pine Flat, it seems to me, wants to make the census-designated place of Pine Flat a separate space. There are a number of shots within the film that if you were to turn the camera 180 degrees, you would see houses, you would see the Pine Flat General Store, you would see, in a sense, signs of a kind of conventional place. There are about between 140 and 160 people who live in Pine Flat. There are, according to the 2010 census, about 16 people that fit the demographic of the film. That is to say, between the ages of 4 and 5 and the ages of 16. So we have a very partial view of Pine Flat. It's being constructed as both a space of childhood and a particular kind of, again, pastoral space within, or that is cut into the space of Pine Flat. And we might want to think about the politics of that at some point, or what's at stake for Lockhart in doing that. What it allows her to do, precisely as it produces a kind of fictional space. And the pastoral is a literary genre and a pictorial genre, which is to say, sort of with no value judgment in the term, a genre of fiction, of the constructing of worlds. The second movement, or second half, of Pine Flat begins here, again on a hillside, and again in a different season, kind of marking the same kind of opening that the fog-covered hillside did at the outset. And here we see briefly entering the screen somewhat late in the running of the 10 minutes, or after one might want it to, a small group of children that move through, but always in the distance, placed elsewhere under the trees. We hear them more than see them and track their voices as they go from the lower right corner of the hillside up to and vanish over the top center of the hill over the course of the 10-minute run. So sound, again, really kind of maps out the opening scene. As in that first scene, you could think of sound as being that which opens up the very taut frame, the very taut tableau of Pineflat, of suggesting a kind of broader framework. At the same time, the sound is also sort of kept insistently ambient and local to the image. And the image is kept, you could say, in relation to the project of painting, the project of the seasons. The referent that Lockhart herself has pointed to is Bruegel's The Hunter's Return from 1565 or something like that, which is part of a now relatively lost or dispersed cycle of the seasons that Bruegel paints. And here again, in the second half, the actions may open in the winter, or the establishing shot is winter, but it is across the summer that the second half takes place. The distinction between the first half and the second half is that where in the first half, each of the figures was a single figure. In the second half, we have couples and small groups. Not to get too far ahead of myself, but if in the first half, the image that you could say is key is something like Winslow Homer's The New Novel, or The Reader by the Brook. In the second half, and this is a further, greater tug on my part, is something like Fragonard's The Progress of Love, and tells the story not so much of the, that maps the sort of aging of the, those individual children across the summer, or the timeless unstructuredness of the summer, from late spring to the school bus's arrival, but to something more like the coming of adolescence, the coming of a certain kind of normative sexuality and pairing off. The opening scene in this kind of really beautiful moment, as though from, again, a Monet bather of 1860 something or other, are a boy and a girl that paddling in a pond, in a kind of deep pond formed by a running creek. So, and it is an exceptionally innocent scene. They don't touch each other, they kind of move around each other, they're talking to one another relatively constantly, but you can't hear it, because what you're listening to is the sound of the water. The sound of the water as it ripples, the water that feeds into the pool as it goes. They're looking for things, fish and shells and things on the bottom of the creek. Occasionally one will dive under and pull something up. It's a kind of wonderfully surface bound, given the shimmer on the water, absorptive scene, but one whose opening of relations, you're not quite clear. These could be brother and sister, they could be neighbors. There's certainly an intimacy there that is not the same as an eroticized or sexualized intimacy. But that is, in a sense, where it moves. The next scene is a scene of three kids that are playing some version of paintball or soft, sort of not Nerf quite, but sort of an arrow soft gun. And there's an arrow soft gun, and they're chasing each other around. And as the scene develops over its 10 minutes, the young woman in the scene eggs on the two boys in the scene to fight with one another in a kind of playful way, however playful that can be. And with a certain amount of there's an edge to it. The scene opens with "I'll get you, motherfucker," which is the one thing you actually hear besides giggles and laughs and yelps and so forth like that. And the scene runs in a game that's clearly both familiar but also eroticized. And again, all the cameras holds back from it, as though this were being, the game was being played under some sort of Barbizon landscape painting, or within some Barbizon landscape painting, or again, at the sort of depths, or the middle depths of something like Fragonard. This is not the progress of love cycle from the Frick, but it is, on the one hand, the game of blind man's buff on the left and the swing on the right, which are themselves clearly pastoral images of other times and other places, imaginary places, situated in relation to the erotic as one of the kind of covering figures for the pastoral, or the pastoral as a kind of sighting for the innocentizing, the whitewashing of the erotic in that sense. And here's the swing. This is older sister, younger sister. And again, there's a kind of ongoing conversation that we're not party to, but it does come to trading off this the swing, pushing one another off the swing, and the kind of deliberate and indeed rehearsed sibling rivalry that's played out for the camera. And I should remark here that this has all been rehearsed. All of these scenes have been shot at least once. First on video, screened for the actors themselves, the children of Pine Flat, conversations made, suggestions made, and then filmed in 16 millimeter. So the sense of, how to say, realism or spontaneity or directness, which you could argue the children give, is also something that is not professional or acted, but it is performed. And one of the things I would go further to say about it is that it's not performed for us, to go back all the way to Michael Fried's Absorption and Theatricality. There's no place over the course of the film where, well, there's one tiny place, but we can talk about that later, where a character looks directly into the camera or entreats Lockhart in one way or another, like, can we do this over? Am I doing okay? Is this working? Should I move over here? What should I be doing? 10 minutes is an awfully long time for a child, particularly the younger children within the film, to be composed. You know, to be without, you could say, direction. It's a remarkable kind of poise that they have in relation to the camera. And that's worth noting, particularly given the penultimate scene of Pine Flat, of two couples kissing in the tall grass. What is striking about it is, in many ways, this is a remarkably chaste scene, that there's none of the things parents might worry about actually happens in this scene. That everyone's hands stay where they belong, so to speak. There's nothing about it that you could say leaves the scene as a presentation, that leaves the scene as a tableau. And the scene itself is already a kind of enacting. It's borrowed from Jean Eustache's My Little Loves, where the two couples walk out from the small town, and each of them moves into the grass around, or at the edge of this road, and begins making out as a kind of experiment, as a kind of possibility, but held within a couple of things, held within the frame, held within a certain kind of vignette or memory, or as Vincent Canby reviewed My Little Loves long ago in the pages of the New York Times, that these seem like, that this is not narrative driven, it's more like a sketchbook, you know, something observed. And Lockhart works with the children in Pine Flat to produced this kind of other space. The space that, again, to stress, belongs to pastoral, but also belongs to, in a sense, occupying a pose, being yourself, kind of building yourself as poised or in a place. Canby, in his review of My Little Loves, compares it to Truffaut, a standard Lockhart linkage, in fact, although Canby hadn't foreseen Lockhart's arrival, and particularly to the Truffaut of Small Change, which had been the site of Lockhart's sort of first cinematic appropriation, or one of her first, and her first sort of use of children as models. This is from Audition from 1993, which asked children, or 94, which asked children to stage, to try out for a scene within Small Change. This is another shot from Jean Eustache, and finally this scene. Now, the framing of this, by which I mean it's both its kind of quite, by which I mean the term quite conventionally, how the rectangle is composed, its flatness, the use of those two figures along the diagonal and so forth, the overwhelming goldenness of the scene, which is borrowed from Eustache, from Andrew Wyeth, from Terrence Malick, from the kind of, from that agrarian or pastoral scene, is also the frame that bounds the work, that again separates the Pine Flat pastoral from the broader world, from the world of school, from the world of clock time, from the world down in the valley. Frances Stark talks in her essay on Pine Flat, which is from the Pine Flat catalog from the Walker. She recounts Lockhart coming in quite distressed because she thinks she has spotted one of her kids, one of the kids from Pine Flat, in a scene from Larry Clark's film, Ken Park, which is was filmed in Visalia, down the hill, 70 miles away from Pine Flat. And as though somehow the world had made it to Pine Flat, or Pine Flat had made it out into the world, or that there was a different genre of film and childhood being represented. This is my kind of my Ken Park image. I could have gone a lot of different ways with Ken Park, but Stark refers specifically to Lockhart being upset about the idea of one of her kids trading bong hits and sad stories with the kids in Ken Park, which is the name of a trailer park in Visalia. Clark, you could say, constructs a very different childhood than Sharon Lockhart does. But Clark, too, references the pastoral. There's a strange way in which both the fully enclosed world that he builds, Clark does, is, you could mark as a kind of link between the pastoral and the pornographic, which Susan Sontag writes about in the pornographic imagination as a kind of singular universe, a universe of its own that has, within which everything is sexualized or eroticized, which in everything works towards a particular kind of theme. So you can, there might be a kind of linkage one could think of theoretically between the pastoral and the pornographic. But more than that, there's a way in which Clark insists on the pastoral taken snidely. There's a film that comes out just before Ken Park called Another Day in Paradise, and his own sort of deluxe coffee table book that comes out in the middle of the 1990s is called A Perfect Childhood. And indeed, the childhood that Clark would like. or would have liked. And he recounts this to Mike Kelly in an interview published in Flash Art in 1993, when both Stark and Sharon Lockhart are students of Kelly's at Art Center, and Clark comes to speak, in fact, in Kelly's class at Art Center. But Kelly publishes an interview with Clark talking about teenage lust in particular, which follows his work in Tulsa, which is his return to Tulsa, you could say, as an adult photographer, and re-embedding himself within the community of sort of speed freak adolescents that were the initial subject matter of Tulsa. And Clark talks about wanting to have had the childhood those kids have, wanting to be those kids, in part, or in no small part, because those kids were having all the fun that he didn't get to have as an adolescent. So his sort of adult projection of his missed sexuality on top of their sexuality becomes the theme or the project, you could say, of Clark's work, his psychotherapeutic work, to borrow a term that he likes, onto the kids of kids, or of teenage lust, or of Ken Park. It's a rather sort of dystopian kind of Lord of the Flies version of childhood. Lord of the Flies being its own separate island, as though childhood has to be for us, as Schiller would write in On Naive and Sentimental Education, or whatever that essay is called, Naive and Sentimental Poetry. As Schiller would write, childhood is, in a sense for us, a kind of other world or separate world. The question is how one ends up constructing it, and how one builds the image of the child, or for that matter, builds the child within the image, and how one works on the question of what an image is and does. So this is Larry Clark's Perfect Childhood. This is a Sharon Lockhart re-photograph, which one might think of as a version of a kind of perfect childhood that might be equally fictional, but set in a different sphere or orientation. In the essay that Stark writes about Pine Flat is called Not Home, Not Church, Not School. Maybe not in that order. Not home, not school, not church, something like that. That is to say, not part of the educational complex, not part of that set of formations that children are run through, that are disciplined in. This is Mike Kelly's 1993 or 4 educational complex, which is his recreation of all the sites at which he is disciplined as a subject, beginning with his house, through his Catholic Church nursery school, through the public school system, to art school at the University of Michigan, to CalArts. When Stark talks about Pine Flat as the possibility of not home, not church, not school, she's talking about the possibility of another kind of space for children, another kind of space in which a child's identity might be built, formed, nurtured. I take a word. I use built in part because Stark talks about the way that Lockhart uses the camera in those 10-minute takes, and the differentiation between that and something like Andy Warhol's Screen Test, the project of which, as various of Warhol's interlocutors and testees remarked, was to kind of eat away at the subject, to eat away at the identity of the subject who was sat there in front of a camera that rolled in front of you. In contrast, Stark suggests that what the kids in Pine Flat learned in front of the camera was, to a certain extent, how to control it, how to be in front of it, how to come into an image in front of it. partly that was, you know, was something like beginning to occupy a pose that was already there. And poses are crucial to the Pine Flat project. I mean, clearly from Jean Eustache to Winslow Homer, poses are crucial. And the way that children within Pine Flats are poised, in a sense, within those poses. But also the way in which they kind of come to control them. The final turn in this, because I do have to kind of reach an ending at some point or another, is an entirely different film. This is a very recent film by Sharon Lockhart called Rodzianko, which is made in Poland over a summer with children from an orphanage who she's set up basically a kind of camp for, a school for. She's brought in a younger Polish philosopher who's gone back to a tradition of the Polish educator Janusz Korczak to try and figure out, as it were, ways in which children can come into or use a language of philosophy and of posing questions and of thinking through broad and deep questions, ways in which to that kind of language and also certain kinds of settings, certain places, you could say, allow for the child to become autonomous, allow for the child, in a sense, to be a member of something, but also to be autonomous within it, to be in control, to make decisions, to ask questions, to be respected. Janusz Korczak's writings become, in part, the source of what will become the United Nations, the Declaration of the Rights of the Child. And he demands, first and foremost, for the child to be respected, but also the insistence that the child's life is for the child and not for us. That is to say, the child is not a future adult, the child is not the future us, the child isn't even quite yet the future them. What they're allowed is the space of, like, now. A space, you could say, that's closer to lived time than to clock time, and a time in which, in this moment, the child is allowed to have a voice. It's interesting, the voice comes up even in Small Change, in that film where auditions come from. In one of the closing scenes of Small Change, a young professor stands in front of a classroom and basically says, you need to get organized, you need to have a political party, you need to insist on the rights of children because nobody else is out there doing that. You need to insist on your rights, make your demands, talk about what it is that you want, and what a life would be like that began, as it were, with the child, rather than with the regimentation of the child in ways that we find more comfortable and more easily manageable within our time. So while Rodzianko is set within the landscapes, it's set within a Polish landscape, but landscapes that read insistently like Claude or Constable and the landscapes of the pastoral, what takes place within it and in Polish and after it in the one version I've seen in English is conversations between two people, between two young people, two young women, talking about issues from their mother's spaghetti to questions of death, to questions of friendship, to questions of institutions, to questions of desires and aspirations, as though this was their time or place. Now, I've insisted throughout on the pastoral as a place, as an agrarian place, a rural place, a place that is tantamount to childhood. I'm fine with all that. The last, very last turn I want to make is that the theorist Paul Elpers, an important theorist of the idea of the pastoral, who's written both a book and a major essay, called What is Pastoral? So that was very helpful to me. borrows from the literary theorist Kenneth Burke the idea of the representative anecdote. what is the kernel of the, what is the kernel of pastoral underneath all or before all of the settings for it? The nature setting, the eroticized setting, the childhood setting, the whatever, the Arcadian classical past setting. What is it that's at the sort of kernel before that? And what Alpers finds at the kernel before that is two shepherds talking. The two shepherds talking, and it's something that William Empson and some versions of the pastoral picks up on. The two shepherds talking are basically simple folk, regular folk, trying to address the conditions of their life and the conditions of the world that surrounds them and the world that, you could say, politics, as one of Theocritus's shepherds is actually dispossessed of his land very early on, find to deal with. And where the pastoral takes place is in this conversation between the two shepherds. And these two shepherds, in their shared thought, their discussion, their philosophy, which takes place, you could say, in the break in the day. It is, from the very early Virgilian and Theocritian pastorals, lunchtime. The sun is high, everyone sits back and relaxes, and it's lunch break, which is the name of another Sharon Lockhart work and a kind of great one filmed far from the pastoral setting, but I would argue within the pastoral mode, insofar as it presents leisure time, unstructured time, the time out of clock time, and the community that is built in conversation there. And that's what I got. So clearly there's time for questions again.
And so to circle back then, is that space of the pastoral, that space of the leisure space or the lunch break, is the implication then that space, if it's equated with childhood, is it then an ageless space? Like, is it not actually about the stages of development by which we usually draw parameters of childhood, but about a kind of freedom to find your autonomous self in a structured society or whatever, and from any age, from any number of age. Like, is it less about, does it become, even though she's using children so much in the films, is it because become less about, by your read of the pastoral, does it become less about childhood and more just about human condition?
I mean, I guess ending with Alpers' thing about conversation, it becomes more about the human condition. But looking at Lockhart's own work, I would say that literally building a space for childhood is something she's sort of deeply engaged in. And the pastoral becomes a place to do that, both because of, as it was, the contingency of Pine Flat, the fact she finds herself there, the contingency by which, where, how she finds herself in Poland. But also I think when she makes the move purposefully to take the children out of the orphanage and out of the city, which had been the subject of her film Podwórka, and into the countryside, I think she's making an equation between the space and relative freedom of the countryside against the against urban space. And again, there's a probably politics to that that are, we might want to interrogate a little farther, but I do think that she's, in her own work, strongly invested in children, and maybe less and less with childhood.
But her audience is also mostly adults, so then she's giving that space, in a sense, to us.
Yeah, no, I would argue that. I would argue that, yes, although I would also say that there's a way in which each of the projects since Pine Flat has had both an internal audience and an external audience. Yeah?
Yeah, this is maybe taking it a little bit away from the work that you're talking about here, but this idea of community and of the internal and external audience, I think is very interesting in terms of some of the things we were talking about in our modern art core class, where we read Lane Relier on Lockhart and how she started out in the 90s as part of a group of artists who seemed to show themselves as very much kind of making work for each other and showing as a kind of enclave set within, but yet somehow separate from the bigger art world. And then he says that in work that she does a little bit later than that, she sort of scales her work up to a great degree to the scale of history painting, not pastoral, but history painting, and either metaphorically or metonymically, doesn't seem quite sure which, matching the scale of the art world as a system. And so I'm just curious about how the actual mechanics of sort of making and distributing and operating within this system, which is somehow seems to be both an art system and a cinema system, and is necessarily very urban-based and metropolitan, how that works for her in terms of her this pastoral desire that she has, or this this urge to go out into the countryside, maybe not in a Maoist sense, but almost in something like that.
Well, there's a couple of answers. One is that this show, by the way, is a great illustration of part one of your question, or Relier's presentation, which is that the show is Sharon Lockhart, Frances Stark, and Laura Owens, who show together as a group, not as a kind of movement or with a manifesto or anything like that, but as a group of friends, which is an interesting thing for three young women artists to do in the 1990s. It's a kind of make your own art world, the DIY, as Lane might say. And at the time, it's the first, I think, commercial gallery show for each of them. And it's also at a time when Blum & Poe, which is now a kind of international conglomerate, you know, that rivals General Motors, is, you know, was about 600 square feet someplace, you know, in a strip mall. So I think the kind of ramping up happens indeed, as you suggest. I would say that it's ironic, but one of the interesting things is that irony is built into the pastoral as a mode. It's William Empson talks about it in some versions of the pastoral, in particular when he talks about it putting complex thoughts into simple mouths. You could think about it the other way, which is that simple, so-called simple people actually think complex thoughts, but Empson's kind of description of it realizes that when Bruegel paints the harvesters and these peasants at leisure, there they are having lunch down at the bottom, that this is painted for a cosmopolitan elite. You know, it is the pastoral is as a literary form for a literary audience. And so I guess you could say it's built into the irony is built into the modality, and I could use Bruegel to get Lockhart off the hook on this. But I would also say that like a number of artists working at the scale of the contemporary art world, one of the things that the contemporary art world allows is for the work to take place. So for a work like Rodchenko to take place, for the farm to be rented, for the young philosopher to get paid an honorarium, you know, things like that. So, which is not money laundering exactly, but it is the scale at which the work is made. So, is that
related to both those questions, and this is kind of a thinking out loud, Thank you for informing. My sense, and having worked on Time Flat with Sharon and Shemit at Harvard, where we actually had an ideal setting where we could show the single figure films in one presentation and the double in another, and rely on students and faculty, the people who inhabited the building, being able to see six different screenings each week over and over. You don't usually get that kind of audience thing. But speaking more specifically, my sense is that there's a weird inversion in Sharon's use of actual children and stronger involvement from Pine Flat to Rodchenko and the girls that she's worked with in Poland. It's almost, there are two things. Conceptually, what's the name of the Polish philosopher, the childhood philosopher?
Oh, Janusz Korczak?
Yeah. I mean, his thinking kind of inverts the pastoral in locating it in, locating the philosophizing, I mean, you just said this, in the child. So that on some level, I feel like what she's been working toward that was not appreciated except maybe by Frances Stark and people who knew her in that, in Pine Flat, she was heavily criticized for the sentimentalizing or the falseness of it, you know, the implausibility and the kind of blotting of certain innocence. But what happened in the transition is almost a schizoid thing. On the one hand, in her life, in a kind of separating a protective relationship to the children she actually works with, whose lives she's invested in, and functioning within the art world, which was not easy for any of those three artists, but especially Frances and Sharon, to ramp up in the way they had to. So there's a schizoid thing where she's ramped up and managed to function and protected something. But also the thing that you just made me think about, you know, it, and I've been thinking about in terms of Rodchenko, is this inversion of the pastoral, where she's actually locating something in children, and it's not exactly the same as the Bruegel. And I don't even know whether I include the irony as the distancing. Irony doesn't feel quite right. There's something that needs to be actually inverted.
Well, a couple of things I would say. Again, there's an interior and an exterior, and that it's in that there's a tension there that remains, but you're right that the Pine Flat I think is a pivot work, mm-hmm. in the sense that there's a relationship it has to auditions and to Khalil Shawn, Woman Under the Influence, in the use of children as actors basically, and the appropriation in Khalil Shawn, Woman Under the Influence of a whole scene of film, right? Or audition as the reference, or at least the appropriation of film, to something more like these children in Pine Flat become, on the one hand, actors for her within these tableaux, but on another hand, they really, she works with them over such a long period of time. And there's a Pine Flat for Pine Flat. Again, there's photography lessons. There's group meals. There's the screening of the film there,
and
the portrait studio. And so there's two different things going on, and it's the interior one that grows, I think, with Podwórko and Rodchenko. In Poland, and it's just, I don't know that it's a full inversion, but you do go from the pastoral as a setting to the pastoral as, the, as it were, the conversation of the shepherds, you know, that you really do go towards the question of a conversation. And that's, really quite interesting to me. The other thing that you bring up is the difference between Pine Flat in the gallery and Pine Flat on the screen. Because in galleries at Harvard, at Gladstone, at the Walker, and elsewhere, the films are, there's a separate room for the first half and the second half of the film, so the single shots and the group shots, but only two scenes are shown in each space
on a given day.
And then the empty canisters or the full canisters are sort of stacked up to kind of signal that there's something else. Now, it's a really great installation, and I can't remember the name of the installation designer she worked with, but... Yeah. So it's a really great installation, but what you don't get in the installation is the sense of the duration, the sense of time that is kind of so crucial to at least my reaction to Pine Flat, or my engagement with Pine
Flat. It's a different duration. Yeah. You actually see it over a week, or 6 days. And there was also the intermission that you, I just realized that the kid who, you know, wandered into the Clark film is the guy who played the music for the intermission.
Oh, Balam Garcia. Yeah, Balam Garcia was his name. There is an intermission, and the intermission is an interesting opening up to the outside, because the screen goes black after the school bus comes, and then the word intermission comes up, and then this child's voice, 11, 12, singing over an acoustic guitar.
Blink
182.
182.
So I've been researching. So and the song there, I mean, as did you, but I more recently. The song is Let's Stay Together for the Kids, which is this kind of divorced parents, all that other kind of childhood stuff that gets cut out of Pine Flat, the film. So the intermission really is a kind of inside-outside opening.
Thank you, Howard.
Thank you all.